This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
I believe this to be the only fair way. Off you go, sir.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. This week, we'll be looking at Season 3 of Love, Death, and Robots, specifically Episode 2, Bad Traveling. Be giving you some interesting insights into a different species interaction, way of life for organisms.
One might say some salacious insight.
Maybe we'll be throwing some crab facts at you. If you want to see it, skip ahead to any of those segments, just check out the time codes below in the description. I am Adam Hasek, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Joining me, as always, is our story specialist, Elizabeth Young, the Baroness and writer at Short Story Soup. Not joining us, because this is a mini-episode for the two mini-hosts of the podcast, are Sam and Dave. Both of them were called away to a conference where the minimum height was at least 6'3". Sadly, Libby and I are only 6'2", so we could not join. So they will not be joining us this week. But, you know, I think we'll survive without them. Maybe.
I'll certainly do better at Limbo.
Much better at Limbo, yes. So in news this week, we're going to give you one mini news because it is a mini episode. There was a bit of, taken from USA Today, a quote, wow moment. U.S. renewable energy hit 28% in April. For those of you that are outside of the U.S., renewable energy, climate change, green building, green thinking is not really a thing that's caught on super well in the U.S. So this is really big that over a quarter of the energy in the U.S. came from renewable sources. And not surprisingly, this was because of capitalism and profit. It was simply more cost effective and cheaper to produce these renewable sources as opposed to continue to rely on things like coal.
I wish there was a way to harness your farts, Adam, because I feel like that would be an unlimited supply of renewable energy.
You know, they blame the cows for methane emissions, or as the people from the savage land of Australia like to call it, methane. But it's probably mostly me driving that hole in the ozone and in the ozone layer and destroying our climate.
So, and his pants.
And my pants. Not the first pair of pants I've blown out. It will not be the last.
They said it will stretch as your cancer pill wears off and your body awkwardly enlarges at the rate of a 50s movie.
Are there pants?
They said you'd prefer just a shirt. Apparently you have a need to swing your dick around.
So as Adam stated before, this is a sort of a mini episode because we're doing just one episode of Love, Death, and Robots, specifically on season 3. And it is titled Bad Traveling. So this is the summary of said episode. No one likes getting crabs, and poor Captain Torrens got the worst possible case of them. A giant man-eating puppeteer enthusiast, Thanapod, tries to Uber its way across the ocean on a ship full of malicious, mutinous, murderous marauders. Torren must save not only himself from his crew, but civilization, as the gravid, gruesome, grotesque wants to unleash its awful offspring on a defenseless, unsuspecting island full of people. Through some odd pre- and post-mortem conversations with the monsters on board, including the crew members.
Literally, the entire crew?
Yes. Torren manages to rid himself of the ship-transmitted destroyer, STD for short, and burn the beastie and its babies to a boil.
I will applaud on behalf of Sam and Dave for the wonderful use of alliteration and STD and gravid. Fantastic word.
I almost made it through without tripping up.
Almost. So, I know for me, this, not only was the animation, as far as what we like, obviously, not only was this animation gorgeous and look
thank you
fantastic.
Oh, not, the episode.
Nope. Anyway, not only was this animation gorgeous and the episode super fun, but this was a really visceral and gruesome and scary feeling creature. The Love, Death, and Robots has had plenty of, you know, horrific things happen in episodes, and some of them more psychological than they are physical, but this one felt very grounded and real, and it felt like what would have happened if a giant crab got onto a boat full of sailors and what that would mean for their lives. So I really
like
that.
Yeah, I liked a lot of this episode. Like, the setting, the creature, like Adam just said, the lighting I thought was really good. Mm-hmm. You don't get a lot of really good lighting on a boat, and I feel like they sold it. The voice acting obviously was great. The what I call the Hensons from Hell puppeteering is really fun, and I just thought it was like a neat short story.
Yeah, I think one thing I also want to touch on that I forgot to mention was the I really enjoyed seeing how clever the captain was. Just from the get-go, he knew who he was working with. He knew what his crew was like, and he was one step ahead of them the entire time. And one step ahead of the crab monster, which is not easy to do when your adversary has so many feet.
I would say he was one step ahead of him after he was one step behind, because he did originally get thrown to the monster. He didn't exactly see that one coming.
No. Well, it was like a random draw, so I think that wasn't necessarily his fault. But he did outsmart the monster immediately. Yes. Which is pretty good.
What didn't you like?
You know, I've been racking my brain for most of the day trying to figure out what I really didn't like about this. And while I would have appreciated seeing this, I think the format as a short story, little episodic piece is the best for this. I wish there was just more of it. More build up, more about kind of learning about the crew and the potential ramifications of where this ship was going. We knew there were people, we knew there was civilization, and that's why the captain was trying to stop the crab from getting there. But it just felt very isolated, and not in the good way that you want a horror to feel, because they do feel isolated in that they're stuck with this monster, but it also just felt isolated in that this wasn't happening anywhere. It just didn't feel grounded to me.
Yeah, to me it kind of almost felt like a miniature shortened version, tropical version of The Terror.
Yeah, I could see that.
A little less cold.
Much less cold.
For me, the entire time I kept wanting to know why this fucking crab didn't just swim to the island. Like, I didn't understand. I obviously could fill in some of the blanks with my creative mapping. But it just seemed really strange from the beginning that it was like so dead set on riding on this boat that it doesn't know how to operate and needs a person to like drive it there, but yet was killing everybody.
I have some theories on that, but I'll get into that in the science part.
Oh, okay.
Do we have any trivium?
We have some trivium. So this was directed by David Fincher, and for those like me who are not great with director names, he is known for films like Seven, Gone Girl, Zodiac, and The Social Network.
Ah, Ted Cruz, Zodiac Killer.
Robot Mark Zuckerberg.
Lizard Boy himself.
Yes. Yeah, and then also Troy Baker is the main voice actor.
Hell yeah, Troy Baker.
Yeah, I heart Joel forever. Yeah. I learned of a new voice actor, and it wasn't so much his skills that caught my attention, but his actual name.
Let's hear it.
Time Winters, folks. If that's not a book character, I don't know what is.
Time Winters?
This man's name is Time Winters.
Time Winters.
And not like the hippie time, like T-H-Y-M-E. I'm talking about like like a watch time, like Time Winters. Yes. Like getting father older. Time.
My body's falling apart because I'm old time.
Last bit of trivia. Calcium carbonate, which is the chemical compound that makes up some crab shells, as well as snail, sea, and egg shells. I thought this was interesting. It's also found in dark green vegetables such as broccoli and kale.
I didn't know that.
And there's strong evidence that it's also found on Mars.
Just like aliens, as we saw from the documentary Invincible.
So let's hope none of the astronauts that went to, well, I was going to say Mars, but no one's been there, are allergic to shellfish.
I'm pretty sure that astronaut Matt Damon went.
Oh, yeah.
So at least one person made it out, you know, eating potatoes.
The actors are calling for an emergency meeting. Already expected to attend are Helen Hunt, George Clooney, Liv Tyler, and Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Before we get into the science, some quick pluggables up top. If you want to find Sam on Twitter, he's at Big Dr. Fishboy, B spelled B-O-I, because remember, he's a cool kid. I am at Hasek Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, send us an email at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. Shoot us a recommendation, tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like. We'd really appreciate the feedback. Speaking of feedback, if you have a moment, just go to whatever podcatcher of choice you're listening to us on. Give us 5 stars, give a quick review. It really helps us out, and we would very much appreciate it. If you want to check out the website, it's cinematicaanimalia.com. If you want to reach out to us on Discord, check out our server, Cinematica Animalia. The link will be in the show notes. You can contact us there and game with us, because Libby, Dave, and I are all avid gamers. Thank you for laughing at me, Libby. I really appreciate it.
Show notes.
I am fancy. I have to fill in for Sam's posh accent.
He is rather posh.
So posh.
So posh, darling.
Speaking of posh, if you want to read a poshful plentitude of short stories, you can go to shortstorysoup.substack.com to see many of the different writings that the Baroness has supplied for us. And if you want to read about some of the more hardcore science that Sam and I and an enormous team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. Now, for the ecology side of this creature, it is a little difficult because it is literally just a giant crab. If that seems surprising to you, look at any kind of photo or video evidence of a crab up close. They might be smaller than you, but they are horrific creatures with quite a number of digits and appendages. And
their mouths are freaky too.
Weird vertical, really weird mouths with a million arms on the side that they can just use. They have like, it's like a Russian doll series of arms where they have the pincers, and then there's a smaller set of arms in between that, and then a smaller set of arms and a smaller set of arms all the way down to their mouth. They can just manipulate and tear up food to get smaller and smaller and smaller to fit into their tiny little mouths. This creature does not have a tiny mouth because we see it quite literally swallow people whole and masticate them immediately into a rather decadent, is not the word I'd like to use because it's a disgusting mass of blood, but the animation on this was top quality, so I have to call this a decadent waterfall of blood across the deck. But I think the interesting thing about this creature is the way that it manipulates, in this case, a corpse to be a puppet. Now, earlier Libby made the point of not understanding why this creature isn't just simply swimming to the island. Crabs can swim. They're not very good at it, but they can do it if they need. And although this creature is quite large and likely very heavy, it would not be the best swimmer, but it probably could if it really needed to. But we learn that it is not only gravid, but very much expecting, and quite literally gives birth on the boat itself. So it would be very difficult and not very energy efficient from a reproductive standpoint to waste all this energy trying to swim and stressing the crab out when it needs to be putting resources towards producing eggs. I don't think it's giving birth to live young. And then, as we see, taking care of the young. So.
And crabs, most shellfish do lay eggs, correct?
Yes. I don't know of any. There are some arthropods that give live birth. It's pretty wild to see, but these are not one of them. So having this, it's not a true parasite, but it's what I'm going to call a social parasitoid. Now, longtime listeners of the podcast will know we went over the different definitions of parasitic lifestyles about a year ago, or a couple months ago at least, with our four parasites in a dissertation episode. But quick breakdown. A parasite is an organism that lives in or on a host organism, and it depends on that host to complete its life cycle and to live. A parasitoid is a very similar type of organism. It doesn't necessarily live on or inside of another organism, but it does rely on killing another organism to complete its life cycle. And that's why it's different, because a parasite wants to take some from its host but not kill it. A parasitoid must kill its host to finish its life. So the moniker before the parasitoid that I said was social. So you have organisms that are parasites, but they are more social parasites than true parasites, because they do take from a host, but it's not taking actual body mass or fluids or blood from a host. They're simply taking resources. There's a group of ants called the slave maker ants that trick other ant hives using pheromones to basically think that they're part of their own hive. So they'll go in, they will trick a bunch of workers, bring them back to their hive, and then have them do all the work for them. So that is why they're a social parasite and not a true taking directly from the host parasite. So because this crab is using these very unfortunate sailors to get, as Libby put it so eloquently, an Uber across the seas to the island it wants to go to with all the people, it is then taking from them, but not in the biological sense, in the social sense. And I'm calling it a parasitoid because it has to kill the humans to grow, to put resources towards its babies, and then for the babies themselves to grow. I'm not physiologically sure of what mechanism you would need to insert a tentacle into another organism that has a completely different body plan and nervous system than you do, because arthropods have weird nervous systems, and then hijack it and not only work into it, but also access enough memories to learn language and the ability to communicate with a completely different species using its language. But if this is an organism that depends on socially parasitizing or parasitoiding a whole other group of organisms, such an ability would be very advantageous and would, I think, be selected for over time.
I mean, this is just like the beast version of Avatar, James Cameron's Avatar.
Yes. And instead of a ponytail being put into a weird back cloaca of a flying pterodactyl thing, it's a horrific crab monster putting a tentacle directly into your spine and using your corpse.
Is it in the spine or is it up the butthole?
It's probably the butthole. It's always the butthole. It's a really weird thing. I don't know of any organisms on, at least that I know of, on Earth that would engage in this kind of lifestyle. There are plenty of social parasites. There are plenty of parasitoids. There are plenty of predators, and there are plenty of very large and scary predators out there. But having that all put together into this big, scary predator that can not only kill humans, but manipulate our bodies, use us to accomplish its needs, and then eat us when it's done with us is truly horrific and really good for this episode.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other reason, aside from just straight communication, that it would need to use a meat puppet, if you will, of a human?
If it's just a meat puppet, no, there's really no use for it beyond communication. But if it was something where it could trick other species and do caring for its brood for it, that would be handy, much like the slave maker ants that I mentioned earlier.
Now, Rebecca runs a popular parenting blog called Mom Magic. Rebecca, I read the blog a lot. My first question is, who the hell do you think you are telling me how to raise my kids?
I'm not going to attempt to fill in for Dave today and go over physiology, but I will give some fun crab facts just because it's a crab and why not?
Crabs are great. And I think if, just in case listeners haven't seen it, I will be posting in the Cinematica Animalia Discord the best image I've seen in recent memory of a small crab holding up a fish above its head on a beach and looking like it's just the happiest, most victorious thing on the planet. And that's the mindset I want you to carry into this next week.
I'm also going to post a picture, which we'll talk about here in a second, and show it to you.
Ooh, sizzle.
Yes. So for those who don't know, like myself, crabs belong to the arthropods family, which means
they are exoskeleton-bearing, jointed, multi-legged organisms.
Yeah, mostly external exoskeleton that protects them. Much like snakes, as we think of, is, I think, the common... Oh my god, that picture.
Look at this crab! It's the best crab there ever was.
It's so cute. Much like snakes, and I don't know if a lot of people know this. I feel like every time I am dumb enough not to know a fact, I'm like, surely other people don't know this. I'm not the only one, but it's probably just
one
me.
One of us.
But yeah, much like snakes, crabs actually molt. Like, they shed their exoskeleton. You know, we think of them changing, like, seashells, if we've seen, like, the crabs that live in, like, conchs and things like that.
Hermit crabs.
Yeah, hermit crabs. But the ones that don't use those shells, and they just have the hard chitin. Isn't it called chitin?
Chitin,
that is it. Yeah, so they shed their exoskeleton. And when they do that, though, they increase their size. They're exposed to predators when they do that. And I think there's a common misconception with the term soft shell crab, that that's an actual species, but it's just the term for a crab that has shedded their exoskeleton. Am I correct?
I think that's right. It's not something that I know a lot about. I was never very big into seafood, so unfortunately when I was an omnivore, I didn't get much into learning about a lot of these creatures. I know less about crabs than I wish I did, because they are a fascinating group of organisms, but... Yeah, that the whole shedding thing is pretty gnarly, because when you have your skeleton on the outside, it makes great protection, but it also really limits any ability to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having your bones grow inside of you and having, you know, your flesh suit on the outside kind of grow with it, you just have to take everything off, grow, and then grow an entire new exoskeleton every time.
That's pretty awesome. As any other decapod, they have 5 pairs of legs. Though the 2 frontal have evolved over time to become a pair of pincers.
Enter Tomatova song.
And they use those to capture prey, fight against enemies, carry out courtship, pinch some sexy crab bottoms.
Hold fish above their heads in victory.
Hold fish above their heads in victory. And the estimated lifespan for crabs, do you know what it is?
Depends on the species, but I think the Japanese, is it the Japanese spider crab or the king crab, can live like 80 to 120 years?
We'll get into that later.
Okay.
You did a spoiler. Maybe we should delete that. Uh-oh. Yeah, so the estimated lifespan for crabs ranges between 3 and 12 years.
Okay.
But that's just like kind of on average, as we'll talk about in a minute. That can jump up quite considerably.
You got a little influential outlier.
Yeah, but crabs are super old. So they showed up actually during the Jurassic period 200 million years ago.
I believe not only did they show up that long ago, but there has been 5 separate times that organisms have evolved into crabs. There was either a really fun Twitter post or an actual paper about this not too long ago titled, "Why Do Things Keep Evolving into Crabs?"
While I won't go into the physiology of our theropod, I did want to kind of talk about his size and by his her.
Or there, they might be a sequential hermaphrodite or simultaneous
that's
hermaphrodite.
That's true. Probably that's not, actually though. Rare in crabs. I did look that up.
I was about to ask you.
Uh-huh. And they're mostly sexed male and female. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about the biggest and smallest known species of crab that we have. So the smallest is the pea crab.
Pea.
And Adam, I think you'd like this. It's a parasite.
Perfect. I think I actually know exactly what these are.
Yeah. So they look, for those who don't know, they look like ticks. They really do. When I looked these up, I kind of got grossed out because it looked so much like a fucking tick. And I hate ticks. And the females are generally attain a carapace about, the females generally attain a carapace significantly larger than the males. The lady average body length is about 0.5 inches or 13 millimeters.
All right.
Which is teeny tiny. And the male remains much smaller, only attaining an average body length equaling about 0.24 inches or 6 millimeters.
And this is not uncommon at all in arthropods to have the female be quite a bit larger than the male. Like we said earlier, you can't really grow when you have an exoskeleton and the female has to hold a lot of eggs. So they tend to be much larger.
Yeah. But yeah, like I said before, it's a parasite. It lives in oysters, clams, mussels, sea urchins, and sand dollars mostly. But they can also be found inside the rectum of sea cucumbers, in the tubes of parchment worms, and in the burrows of mud shrimp, or the gills of sea squirts. And no, that's not an Urban Dictionary term.
Sea squirt is a real thing. Look it up. But make sure you're not looking it up on Urban Dictionary. Fun fact about sea cucumbers. I just learned recently that they have evolved teeth-like structures in their butt to keep organisms from living in there. Because
like
it happens
a pea crab.
So often. Just munching down on something with your butt gives butt chug an entire new meaning.
Or butt munch.
That too.
But what is the biggest crab of all?
Emperor crab?
No.
Japanese king crab?
The Japanese spider crab.
That's what I meant. I said it earlier, but it got cut out.
With the leg span of 13 feet or enormous 4 meters and an average weight of around 40 pounds or 16 to 20 kilograms.
Kilograms.
It's truly the King Kong of crabs.
40 pounds might not seem like a lot, but remember, this is a crab.
Yeah. Look up pictures of these things and you'll understand.
A dog the size of a small golden retriever. A crab the size of a small golden retriever with legs that would reach across your entire bedroom.
Yeah.
With room to spare to grab you in the bathroom.
It may also have the longest lifespan of any crab, living to be about 100 years old.
Which is really cool.
Yeah. However, Japanese spider crabs do not survive very long without injury because their long legs are weak. A study found that 3/4 of surveyed crabs were missing at least one limb. So it's sort of like why super, super tall basketball players don't make it very often either.
Blood circulation and nerve endings are a problem.
Them knees go. To protect themselves from predation, this is adorable, the smaller and younger crabs decorate their shells with objects such as kelp.
It's really cute. I'd rather be shiny
treasure from a sunken pirate wreck.
Okay. So honorable mention for size is...
the coconut crab, the crab that Tomatoa from Moana is based off of. And while not as large in a physical dimension standpoint as the Japanese spider crab, they are enormous. And I think they can weigh up to 60 pounds or 28, 25 kilograms, something like that. They are quite large.
And they actually live in coconut trees.
They will climb out of the fucking ocean and up a tree to get some goddamn coconuts because they are, because fuck you, that's why.
Incredible.
They're horrifying. Look up pictures.
Sometimes you just really gotta have some hydration, you know, and that coconut water is like
really
the
water.
Ultimate hydration.
It's for my skin.
Also honorable mention for size, which is the second biggest crab next to the Japanese spider crab, is the Tasmanian giant crab.
Does this one spin around in circles and talk in gibberish?
It does not.
Well, we found it in Tasmania, and it's large. I know, we'll call it the Tasmanian giant crab. Sometimes scientists are not the most creative people on the planet.
Yeah, the Tasmanian giant crab is, in fact, giant in Tasmanian.
Hmm.
It's very, very big. Honorable mention for just being weird as fuck. Trust me, look this one up. The Yeti crab. And why is the Yeti crab so special, Adam?
Because it's got big, hairy fucking arms.
I'm looking at a picture right now, and it looks like if a dog tick fucked a Muppet.
Fucked a critter from the Critters movie.
Yeah, I could see that. But yeah, it's got legitimate... almost orangutan arms.
It's bizarre. I'm pretty sure they live in Antarctica, like really cold environments. So I guess it keeps it warm.
I think they're deep sea. So they're inhabit hydrothermal vents and cold seeps at deep sea levels.
Mm.
For my story section today, I, much like Love, Death, and Robots, I'm going to keep this short. As in short story.
In bloody?
No.
Full of crabs?
Yes. Writer's tip. I wanted to say, you know, we've talked on the podcast before about the somewhat ridiculous process of scientific publishing, right, Adam?
Mm-hmm.
And all that entails. But I wanted to give a helpful tip for our listeners who want to be writers. And the tip is short stories. So if you want publishing houses or agents to take notice of your submissions, it's really helpful to have a sort of CV of your published works. That's kind of how it works. You send in a query letter, and if your query letter has, I've done nothing, but here's my book, read it. They're like, nah, I'm good. So instead of writing 10 novels and trying to get those published, try 10 short stories instead. So getting your short stories published is a great way to beef up that query letter. Sort of like sending your resume en masse when you're trying to find a job. You just send out as many of those short stories as you can. I know that Stephen King actually did this for his career. So he sent out a ton of short stories and started with publishing some for free, and then he got paid for some, obviously not very much because no one likes the arts. And then it gave him enough credentials to eventually have a publishing house look at Carrie more seriously.
It's a tough thing being a writer, academic, non-academic, whatever. But I think that to really kind of edify what Libby's saying, this format works so well for so many different creative stories, and it's sometimes a better way to go about it. I mentioned earlier that I wish that there was more to this, but I also acknowledge and will probably have to revise that a bit by saying that if there was too much more to this, it wouldn't be the same. It would be padding it out, the Hobbit trilogy, adding too much when it doesn't need it, Hunger Games split up into two movies. But... it makes for a very compelling, very tight, and very structured story. And it's much more enjoyable to listen to and to experience, whether you're sitting down to read it or if you're watching it here on the silver screen.
Yeah, and I think short stories in general, just speaking as a writer, it's such a good way to sort of vet ideas almost. So if I have an idea, say like I want to write about a man who wants to use his farts as renewable energy, I can say in my head, I think I have a book for that, but writing it out as a short story actually might give me a better concept of if that's going to really pan out or not. You know, take wind, if you will. But yeah, so it's a great way to sort of figure out what ideas are really tenable, and what ideas should kind of remain as short stories, because some really do. They just work better in that format. You know, it can be like a snippet versus just a drawn out thing.
It could even be a super short story. There was I can't remember if this was a collection of these short stories in one book, or if this was a website or like a literary challenge that people had to submit to. But one thing I've always remembered is it was a collection of 2-sentence horror stories. And the one that I will always remember is, it goes like this. First sentence, the last person on earth sitting in a room, period. And there was a knock at the door. That's it. And it, like, that's 2 sentences. That's not even a short story. And that has stuck with me for years. And I think that it's great. We don't need a 14-hour movie. We don't need a simple story split into 4 different movies. It can be a short story, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, so those what you're talking about, Adam, is called flash fiction. And those can be, you know, about 200 words, but they can be considerably less. Another very, very famous example that we were made to study in school, and it's a fucking horrible, horrible short story because it's super sad, is by Ernest Hemingway. And the story is For Sale, Baby Shoes, Never Worn.
Which is grim. I feel like the first time I heard that, it never really clicked. And it wasn't until a long time afterwards, like, oh, their baby died before they even got to wear their shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that that's kind of the power that short stories can have. You know, if Hemingway had expanded on that, it would have really lost all of the power to the flash fiction. So yeah, short stories are great, all in all.
Mm-hmm. They're great! So next week we'll be moving away from marine aquatic horrors into more of a whimsical fairy tale land with 1988's Willow.
Hell yes, I am so excited about this because this is peak childhood right here.
So we will see you next week with Willow. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Out of the way, peck!
Protects.
It's not for you.